Tonight you have the nuns to do the Q&A. Whether good or bad, who knows? Yes, start with the first one. Address to me. The Venerable Gotami, you are the kindest grandma I knew, had, and I never had. And seeing you at this retreat brings me a lot of joy and tears during my meditation. Thank you for attending this retreat. I wish I could give you a big hug, but not sure if it's breaking nuns' rules. Are you able to share with us your journey to becoming a nun? How and why you choose to become a nun? Because you are such an inspiration. Thank you, Venerable Gotami. Send you lots of hugs and more hugs. Well, I came from Malaysia in 1989 on the 1st of January, and I've been here almost 30 years. How I became a nun was after my husband passed away. We had four children, four boys. And after he passed away in 2005, after a short illness, he had cancer of the stomach. And it only took about 10 months and he left us. So my friend from Malaysia called up to send her condolence. And on speaking with her, she invited me to go with her to Burma to do a 5-month retreat. And I spoke with my son. And my son said, "Mom, it's, no, sorry. She said that we go for 1 month." And so I told my son said, "It's a 5-month retreat. Why do you want to go for 1 month?" I said, "What about the household things? Got to look after." He said, "Don't worry, Mom, you go ahead. I take care of it." So with his blessing, I arranged to go, and we left from Singapore. I also have another son in Singapore. So he wanted to accompany me to Burma to see where I'm going, with whom I'm going. So he took about three or four days to leave. And so we went. And I was there for actually 4.5 months. And the Siale who taught us the retreat, she decided that after 4.5 months, she had enough. So after that, when I went back to Malaysia, I was looking for a place where I can have a long retreat. I wasn't so interested in 9-day retreat anymore. So I spoke with Ajahn Brahm to stay in either Jana Grove or Bodhinyana Monastery, but it was only for 2 weeks maximum. And then suddenly, I remember, oh, what about Dhammasara Monastery? So I spoke with Ajahn Vayama, who was the previous abbot of the monastery. and she was happy for me to stay there indefinitely. There was no other lay person, and I was the only one there, so I was able to offer them breakfast and then take care of the dana time and drive them wherever they need to go. So after that, after some time, I decided that maybe I like it very much there because I was quite happy. I'm not a person who usually likes to go here and there. I'm usually quite homely. So staying quietly in Dhammasara Monastery seemed to suit me quite well. So I had to speak with my children first, get their blessings. They were very happy that I wanted to become a nun. And so I spoke with Ajahn Vayama, and after going back and forth with Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm said, yes, yes, because I'm over age. So okay, I took time off to Malaysia and Singapore to say goodbye to my family, the rest of the family, and then after that I came back. And when I came back, Venerable Upeka and another girl from Sydney was there. So when it was time, the three of us were ordained as Anagarika together. Then after that, after 1 year, no, 15 months of being an Anagarika, if we wish to become a seminary, we have to request for it. So we requested, and we were ordained as novice nuns in Dhammaloka Buddhist Center. Then, so after another 2 years, it was time for us to request again if we wish. So we requested to take up bhikkhuni ordination. So in 2011, 27th of April, we were ordained as bhikkhunis. Well, you asked about whether I'm breaking precept if you give me a hug. I don't know whether you are a man or a woman. But if you are a woman, well, can oblige. But if you are a man, no. We don't even shake hands with a man. So, I think that's about it.
Lucky dip. Oh. Says, please share your experience of beautiful breathing. How is it? I'm not quite sure. Appears for how long? About. So on the beautiful breath, I think. So my understanding is this is more or less Ajahn Brahm's term, the beautiful breath, something that I think he talks about in his stages of meditation, so I'm sure you're all familiar with that. From my own perspective, my own practice perspective, the breath is something quite neutral. And it can change as your mind state changes, or the appearance or the experience of the breath changes as your mind changes. So really it's just a reflection of what's, to some degree, to a large degree, what's going on with your mind. So when Ajahn Brahm talks about the beautiful breath, my understanding is more the mind has calmed down, the body has calmed, the breath has calmed. The mind is relatively calm to the point that there's some piti and sukha in the mind, some happiness and pleasure and joy arising. And this experience can be described as beautiful. I'm sure you all know just that experience of coming to a place of rest or breathing out, or even looking at a sunset when your own body and mind become stilled even by the beauty of the sunset. There's something more than just the beauty of the colours. The beauty is within you, isn't it? You feel the joy or the restfulness. So from my perspective, the beauty is in the mind, and very much when the mind is beginning to still, becoming less fragmented, because our habitual mind states are usually very fragmented, and that's not very beautiful. That's when we experience dissatisfaction and discomfort and suffering or distress to various degrees. But when the mind, the breath and the body become still, we experience a certain coherence. And this is just the mind in its natural state. So we're defragging. Yeah, we're just so habituated to being fragmented, we think that's normal. But Ajahn Chah very much said actually the natural state of the mind is already peaceful. So when we defrag, we come in to experience that. And from my perspective, this is when you can experience the breath becoming what we call beautiful or light and still. And some people will experience the breath as a kind of an energetic experience. So the breath may no longer be that which moves up and down vertically in the body, maybe begins to feel quite osmotic, like the body is breathing through every pore. And that has a certain pleasantness to it. And this thing we call the breath, it's an energetic formation. So in a way it can take different shapes according to our perception. In meditation, our perception changes as our mind changes. So what we think of the breath in one mind state, the breath can appear very differently in another mind state. But nevertheless, the beautiful breath is always associated with that calm, stilling, and the joy and the peace and the beauty of a still mind.
All venerable nuns. There are always two sides to everything. Can you kindly tell us about the most inspiring things, the most difficult things in the monastic life, like fear of dragons living in the forest? Dangers living in the forest. Dragons would be cool. Inspiring things. Just all the wonderful people that we meet. We don't get dodgy people coming to the monastery. We only get really good ones. People who are so very, very generous and kind and inspired and inspiring. So all the people who come even only occasionally just to give food, and some people who come every week or every twice a week to feed us, just because they're so inspired by monastics generally. So they're inspiring to me. It makes me want to live up to their hopes. And the most difficult things, same stuff that everybody else has. You know, if someone says something that you're like, oh, what's that? That's a difficult thing. But you're in the best possible place to deal with those sorts of things, which is why it's also inspiring. So the difficult things are good things, I think. So hopefully that answers your question. Maybe.
This other one is also, dear Venerable Gotami, can you please tell us a bit about yourself? I think I've told you. Venerable Gotami, how do you calm a restless mind? When you sit down to meditate and your mind is going all over the place, you just relax and breathe slowly and try to slow the mind down. If it's too restless, you can get up and walk. You walk for a while, and then after that, you try sitting again. And while you are sitting, sometimes the mind still won't stop becoming calm. So you do something else for a while, and after some time you come back to the meditation. Sometimes the mind is very stubborn. You can try to calm it down, but it won't come down. So you just stop for a while, maybe have a cup of tea, go for a walk, and then you come back, sit down, and try again. You may feel better after that.
So this one just says, to the Venerables from New South Wales, we welcome you two. We sincerely ask the two of you to help Great Eye Naroda to steady and improve Santi. Any comment? So for those of you who don't know, Santi Monastery is a forest monastery, forest nuns monastery just south of Sydney, where myself and Venerable Jayasara are now ordained and practicing, and those of you who know Venerable Naroda is a senior nun there at the moment. So Santi has had a few years since Santi Sujato left it for the nuns in 2012 or 2013 as a bhikkhuni monastery, and there's been different nuns staying for periods of time over there. For myself and Venerable Jayasara, who've come more recently, it certainly is our intention to want to support Santi Monastery to stay as a place for bhikkhunis, as a forest monastery, because it's so rare to have a real forest monastery for bhikkhunis. So rare to have bhikkhunis, but so even more rare to have a real forest monastery for them to practice in. So it's very precious. So we do want to support Aya Naroda and Santi itself to be a place for women and bhikkhunis to practice into the future. But having said that, you know, it depends if our karma is with us. You know, every place and every person has their own karmic baggage. So you can't force the hand. You can't say this will be successful no matter what. We can only do our best and keep practicing and keep being inspired by the intention of Santi, and hopefully the karma of the place and the people who come will be supportive for the fulfillment of its vision.
Dear Venerable Sarata, please tell us about your spiritual journey. How did you decide to become a Buddhist nun? Was it hard to decide? If someone like a nun would like to become a nun, what should she do? Wow, big one. I was brainwashed by Ajahn Brahm. I came on a few retreats and then I decided to stay. So be careful. I turned to meditation because life was rubbish. And I met some really nice people at Nolamara. And so going on retreats, and then as my practice developed, I realised that for it to develop more, I needed to spend time in a monastery. So I knew Venerable Hasapanya from the committee, so I asked her about it, and that's the answer to the last question. You ask Venerable Hasapanya to come and stay for a little while. So I asked Venerable Hasapanya. She said, "Oh, well, come and have a look. You know, spend the weekend or a week or whatever." So I did that, and I went back for another weekend and another weekend, and then I went for 3 months. All little while, I'm not telling my mum. I think I'm becoming a Buddhist nun. I said to my mum, "I'm going for a retreat. I'm going for a few months. I'm going for a year." "Oh, Mum, I'm in ordaining next weekend. Would you like to come along?" and she's like, "Oh, okay." So that was only a little while ago. It wasn't hard to decide because I did it. It was gradual. It was, I'll do the next bit and I'll keep trying it out and I'll keep trying it out. And Ajahn Brahm says, if it's not a prison, it's only a prison if you don't want to be there. And I want to be there, and even though there's a lot of rules, I want to be there. So, and they are supporting my practice, so it's actually really good. And meeting all the nuns was a big help, because the more time I spent with them, the more I realised how good they are, how inspiring they are to be with. So if someone would like to become a nun, she should get in touch with Venerable Hasa. She's really kind and friendly. Of course, the other alternative these days, which didn't exist before, is to get in touch with Venerable Chitindria at Santi if you want to try. And it's always encouraged to try different monasteries because, they're different types of ways of practice, different atmospheres, different teachers. And you've got to go where you're learning something when you're growing. If you feel like you're not growing, it's not the right place. So, Venerable Hasapanya always encourages us to try. Speak to her. She'll tell you, come along for a short stay, come along for a bit longer, come along for a bit longer. Just give it a try. But we do have a waiting list. If you're international, I think you'll be waiting a while. So definitely look around local, wherever you live, because visa laws are ridiculous. So, next.
What are all of your backgrounds and what led you to Buddhism? Thank you. When I was small, my mother only practiced traditional, praying with joystick, candle, and gold and silver paper. So I used to help her with that because whenever she prays to my father's family, those who are deceased, because during that time, the women folk are really very obedient. They pray for their husband's family. They don't pray for their own family. and she used to have a table out and cook all kinds of dishes, put it on the table, and the rice we scoop onto the small bowls and make it very high like a mountain. So there are about 6 bowls with chopstick, spoons, and 2 small little cups. So all of these, one tea, Chinese tea, and one wine, Chinese wine. So I've been doing that with her. But then when I grew up, my younger brother, he's the youngest in the family of 8. He became very interested in Buddhism. He was working then, and he's always meditating. And even when he was working, he was also eating, he was taking 8 precepts, and he doesn't eat in the evening. So we were quite inspired by him. And after that, he became a monk in the Mahayana tradition. And he went over to America. So from that time onwards, I heard that Buddhism, you don't need all this gold and silver paper. So I stopped buying them, stopped using them, because this gold and silver paper is like money, and the money you give to your ancestors, you burn them and they're supposed to receive it. So anyway, so I stopped doing all this, and but he was away so far, and that time he was quite in his early stage of monkhood. But after 3 years, he decided that he wanted to follow the Theravada tradition. So he came back to Malaysia, and he went to Thailand, and he ordained in the Theravada tradition. So actually, he is the one who pulled us into Buddhism. We know nothing about Buddhism. So after that, we initially, because initially he was a Mahayana, so Mahayanas, they are vegetarian. So when he is vegetarian, we are also vegetarian. And then when he changed to Theravada, no more vegetarian, we are also no more vegetarian. And then after that, I was very busy, because having a family of 4 children, and so only when we move over here that I started going to Dhammaloka Buddhist Center, because friends from Malaysia who have migrated here told us that, oh, there's a very good center there. The monks come and teach Buddhism. So we went there. And so from that time onwards, I became very inspired. At that time, when I first went, it was Ajahn Jagaro, the previous abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery. So he was teaching. But after that, he disrobed, and Ajahn Brahm took over as the abbot. So Ajahn Brahm really inspired me a lot, and from that time onwards, I know what Buddhism is. Otherwise, we just follow the traditional ways. So So that's how I got into Buddhism.
Do you want me to answer this too? So my background's a bit different, having grown up in Australia and probably quite a typical Australian family. My mum was Catholic and my dad was atheist. And he let her bring up the children as Catholics until such a time as we could decide for ourselves, which I thought was very wise in retrospect. So I think by the time we all got to about 14 or 15, we were dropping out from going to church. Nevertheless, I was brought up as Catholic and in a Catholic girls' school, and I had three older brothers. So for me, introduction to Buddhism, it was, you know, there's different stories that one could tell, so I'll just keep it fairly brief. As a teenager, I was always interested in art as a child. I seemed to have a bit of a natural ability with art, so I always gravitated to that in school, arts and crafts. And when I left high school, I went to art school and left home at 17 and moved interstate to go to art school. And art, you know, became, even from the time in school practicing art, it was very, it was very interesting to me because it took me to a place of awareness. It took me into a zone of, in retrospect, I would say mindfulness, observing what I was about to paint or draw and just letting the eye observe and just this relationship between seeing and looking and experiencing. So really, over the years, just becoming more and more interested in the process of perception and sense consciousness. But what was interesting about it to me, even as a young girl, was that little insights would arise. I didn't have any language for it, but little truths, bubbles of understanding would arise. I couldn't articulate it, but to me, something about the process of art seemed to reveal truth. So in a way, art was my religion for a while. And I thought everyone should be doing this because, you know, it's just so profound. But I couldn't articulate really what was going on. But later, as I moved through art school, my inquiries into the nature of mind and consciousness from an artistic perspective, I guess, became more existential and more spiritual as I grew into my late teenage years and early 20s and started experiencing the angst of a teenager and someone in their early 20s. And this was in the 70s as well, so life was pretty out there for an art student, so experimenting with all sorts of things and having lots of fun on the one hand, but becoming acutely aware of suffering internally and externally on the other. So my search became more and more spiritual, and so that led me into reading things beyond art, different philosophies, even went back into the Christian side of things, just, you know, rereading the Bible, thinking, was there anything there, you know, what's all this about? So experimenting with different things, but I had no exposure to Buddhism at that time, but started to encounter some more oriental philosophies. And at that stage, TM, Transcendental Meditation, started sweeping through colleges and universities in Australia, so there was some exposure to that. And exposure to Ram Dass's, I don't know if any of you here remember Ram Dass's book, Be Here Now, Be Here, Be Now, a purple book of the 70s. So a few things like that started to find its way to me, kind of mind-expanding content, really. So I was just following my intuition. I knew there was something out there that I needed to understand, that I needed to know. I think I must have been a Buddhist in a previous life, because the essential driving question for me was around suffering. Why is there suffering? And a strong intuition that if one could understand this, one could find peace. I couldn't articulate it at the time, but that was the intuition and the search. And so I just followed my sense of things, really, being a bit adventurous, and travelled with a friend overseas through Asia and Europe, and eventually got to England, having some interesting experiences along the way. But it was when I landed in England, I thought, right, the answers aren't out there. You know, now I've really got to learn how to meditate. The answers must be in here, or at least the search needs to go inwards. And then just things started happening serendipitously, really. Where I was working at the time, I opened the local paper, and free meditation classes at a local Burmese Vihara just around the corner. So, okay, I can start to learn to meditate properly. And after going there for a few months, Dr. Rewata Dharma was the senior monk there. This was in 1986 and 87. I was about 23 at the time. And when I was leaving Birmingham and going back to London, I asked where I should continue to practice meditation. And the monk said, you should go to Amaravati Monastery. So Amaravati had just been established in 1984, so this was just 3 years after that. And just with strong faith, really, I just went back to London and booked myself in on a retreat at Amaravati Buddhist Monastery, where Ajahn Sumedho and other Western monks and nuns also were establishing a community. So that was it, really. I went along on a 10-day retreat led by Ajahn Amaro at the beginning of, must have been 1987, March 1987. And it kind of really struck me. I hadn't done a retreat before, so I kind of dived in on a 10-day. But everything that was said and taught just rang all these bells. And I thought, my God, this is what I've been looking for. I didn't realize I was looking for a religious path or a spiritual path like that, but it was like, as I've said in the past, you know, I brought my little wet paper bag of insights along to this retreat, and Ajahn Amaro as a teacher, just it felt like that he just cast this incredible tapestry and said, well, there's all of this as well. And I thought, wow, this is a great path to develop. So I got very excited about Buddhism and meditation, and travelled around England just doing different meditation retreats. But I kept coming back to Amaravati and feeling more and more at home at Amaravati. And over the course of a year, I realised actually I could ask to stay and ordain there. I could join the community, which was quite a large international community at that time. So that was a long time ago. Like, this is Jitendriya Mark II, because at that stage I ordained as a nun and was a nun for 17 years up until the end of 2004, when I left the monastic order in England, and for various different reasons that it came to that. So this Jitendriya Mark II is very recent. I've taken ordination again at Santi Monastery just last month, with about an 18 months of moving towards that. And it was a surprise. It was a surprise that this came about again. It wasn't really planned. I've got a big history with Santi Monastery, but it's interesting, I didn't visit Santi until, 18 months to 2 years ago. I'd visited as a nun previously, and this time Ina Rota was there, and just something about that visit, something about the time in my life, and also just a deepening desire to focus more and more on meditation. And suddenly there was an opportunity to take robes again. So it was very confronting. It was like, how committed are you then? You know? How often does this opportunity come by twice in one's life? You know? What's holding you back? What do you really want? So these kind of, you know, questions. It's like, yeah. And, you know, the Dharma was still very much at the center of my life and my heart. So I thought, it's worth taking this opportunity again. Because it's probably not going to come by a third time in one lifetime. So I dived in. But very pleased to be able to, because we didn't have bhikkhuni ordination available to us as nuns previously. So that only came about in this Theravada tradition in 2009 with Ajahn Brahm. So that's a big reason why I wanted also to take the opportunity this time to be able to take bhikkhuni ordination eventually if it works out. And to really support the growth of the bhikkhuni community in modern Australia.
I suppose I only half answered that question earlier. I went to learn to meditate, but my journey there was quite long as well, but not that different to Venerable Jitendra's. I also raised very Catholic. But I was a bit rebellious, a bit younger than 15. I think I was about 8 or 9 when I refused to go into a church again. And I was very stubborn, so I won. I went along to Dhammaloka. And, yeah, Ajahn Brahm was giving it. I stayed for the meditation and then I came out and there was a couple hundred people in there. I thought, oh, maybe I'll just stay and listen. And one of the things he was talking about was karma and rebirth, the thing most likely to turn me away. But the very first thing he said was, now you don't have to believe me. Can't prove I'm right. You can't prove I'm wrong. So just leave it on the shelf. So I thought, okay, I can do that. So that's how I started. But I think I've answered the rest of the question. So I'll move on to the next one because it's 8:45 already. Dear nuns, today the boss is not here. Missing ingredient is jokes. Can each one of you give us a joke, please? I picked up the wrong question. I'll tell you one, and it's terrible. This was told to me by the plumber who installed our UV lamp for water filtration system. He said to me, someone asked me the other day, do you like cats? I said yes, but I wouldn't eat a whole one.
Terrible. Yeah, Venerable, go to me. Can you please tell us something about Dhammasara? Can anybody visit the place? How do we get there? Dhammasara Monastery is in Gijigenep. And how you get there, I think you look at the map. Well, it started when I went there for training. There were 4 nuns. That's all, and only one layperson, that's me. And now it has grown to 10 bhikkhunis, 3 anagarikas, no, 2 samaneris, 3 samaneris, and 2 anagarikas. When I'm a bit nervous, I can't count very well. So anybody can go there. You know, we are open in the for dana every day. The dana starts at 10:30, and then we have a bit of chanting, you know, blessings. And then after that, It's just like Bodhinyana Monastery. People go and get the rice and line up, pindabat, just the same. So we have got accommodation pods of, there are 12 rooms. One set of accommodation pod is for lay people, 6 rooms for lay ladies. And the other 6 rooms is for monastic. I'm in one of them because I'm old. I stay in the accommodation pod is safer for me. Don't have to walk through the forest. I was staying in the forest for many years, but the work became quite heavy because I had to climb up the ladder and clean the gutter. And sweep around, raking around is all right, but climbing up and down, you know, a bit tiring. So it's a good time for me to move to the accommodation pod. There we have got a small room, and it's about the room of like Bodhinyana Monastery, their kuti. But it's actually quite like jhana growth because there are 6 rooms. And for the monastic, we have got our bathroom, our toilet outside. You have to walk out, and it's within the same building, but you have to walk out to another room before you get to the toilet and the bathroom. But for lay ladies, they have got ensuite. So 2 rooms share bathroom and toilet. Yeah, and many people come and stay. Very popular. So, and those who are interested want to stay longer, see how they fare, whether they like it there or not. Yeah. And if you stay there long term, you have to help with the work, like kitchen work. Usually it's more kitchen work and maybe sweeping around. But the anagarikas will do more of the driving. So there are some people there who are quite interested to become nuns, and they are staying there for 3 months to see how it goes. And then after that, they may try somewhere else. So don't know. it's very welcoming to people. And we also have another block of 3 rooms, and it's for sometimes male want to come, they can stay, but on recommendation. So if somebody knows them and recommend them, or nuns family, male can go there and stay, but not during the rains retreat. Rains retreat is fully booked, so even there also, for the male side also, ladies will be staying there. So other than rains retreat, they can always apply and see.
We're obviously not going to get through all these questions. it's tempting to want to kind of pre-read them, but I guess we'll just... Dear nuns, my questions are to those of you who wish to answer. What have you found the most challenging in your change in lifestyle and becoming a nun? And what have you found the biggest blessing in becoming a nun, which you didn't find in your lifestyle choice before that? I don't know whether to talk from Jitendriya Mark 1 or Jitendriya Mark 2. I think what is the most challenging in the change of your lifestyle and becoming a nun? I guess for me at the moment it's about around gut issues, because you can't choose your food anymore. You know, so that's a big one these days. It's a big one even if you haven't got any digestive problems. But if you have got digestive problems, it becomes even trickier. So that's quite challenging on all levels, not just physically, but, you know, you worry, your mental worry, and you can work into a big thing about it, or you can really use it as a, you know, you have to be careful for some things, but you just have to also look at the mind that worries, or the mind that wants to control, or, you know, or one's preferences. Or so that's quite challenging, the in the lifestyle change. Adapting to that, but on the other hand, it's also a great blessing in many ways that you don't have to choose your food anymore. You don't have to go shopping. You don't have to do your meal plans or whatever for your family, and all this wonderful generosity, people giving amazing generosity to support a monk or a nun in their practice is incredibly inspiring for us as monastics, and a beautiful thing, a beautiful tradition that goes all the way back to the Buddha, obviously. So one of my experiences as a nun previously is going on Tudong, where you leave the monastery with just your robes and your bowl and a few things, and go with a few other nuns and go walking. And sometimes, depends, you might have a pre-planned walk where you're going to go, or sometimes not. And I did Tudong a couple of times, and on both of those there were many times where we didn't know where we were going to stay, we didn't know where we would get food. You just, if you arrive at a village in time, you usually plan your walking so you can arrive at a village in the morning and stand there for alms. And the first times that I used to do this, even when we went arms around from the monastery, we would walk several miles into the village and stand on arms around. And it's quite embarrassing at first when you're a Westerner and you're not used to this tradition and you're just standing there. It feels embarrassing because your conditioning is to, you know, pull your own weight, to look after yourself, not to expect anything from others. And but it was so good to learn how to do this in England, because the English people are very charitable, and they saw, you would see, they often would think you may be Christian nuns as well. You're standing with your arms full, you're not supposed to ask for anything, but if people offer, you can receive food. But many were looking for the slot to put money in your alms bowl. Then you'd have to explain, oh, I'm sorry, we can't receive money. Well, what is it that you want? What is it that you need? Well, we can receive food for our daily meal. And so many people would just go off and buy some food and come back and put it in an alms bowl. And it was really amazing, you know, and people that weren't even Buddhist would come along and say, what are you? What are you doing? And they were just so charitable and so supportive that you soon relaxed into that vulnerability. Really, the embarrassment that I spoke of is vulnerability. You really kind of put yourself out there. And you're not sure if you are going to eat that day. So when, you know, and you keep your focus on your alms bowl, and suddenly, you know, this sandwich shows up in front of your alms bowl, and there's just this, oh, wow. That's really kind. You know, this manifestation, but there's such beauty in this act of both giving and receiving when you're really present in that moment. And because being on Tudong or arms around, the stakes were much higher, so you're much more present in a way. But there can be those moments of pure joy for both giver and receiver. There's no expectations on either side, really. Just this enjoyment of the act of generosity and renunciation. That's where generosity and renunciation really are one and the same thing. It's the act of opening the heart, letting go, giving, receiving. When giving, receiving becomes one. So, the greatest challenge can also be the greatest blessing, as one of the Venerables said earlier.
None has more rules than monks. Would you please give some example of the rules that nun has to follow, but not the monk? Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. The nuns have got so many rules, 311. Monks only got 227. I don't know why. The Buddha did not lay down the rules just by thinking that people, they may break this rule and this and that, but he won't. He only waited until the nuns, if they make an offense, then somebody will go and report to the Buddha, and he will lay down a rule. So every time an offense is made, then only he will put it down. Sometimes, like the nuns, they may travel alone, and some of them get raped because they are staying in the forest. And it's not like nowadays, you can go many places and it's quite safe, but not during the time of the Buddha. So the Buddha put down the rule that nuns cannot cross the river alone, because sometimes there's a ferry that takes people across. A nun cannot cross alone, because it happened that the boatman raped the nun. So they have to go like with another nun, or they go to the village. They cannot go by themselves. Or if they go on Pindabat, like a group of nuns are walking, you cannot lag behind so far that people cannot see you. So that is also an offense. So these offenses, it doesn't apply to the monks, because it's more dangerous for the nuns to be by themselves. So that's how some of these rules are different from the monks. In fact, many of the monks' rules have been taken and used for the nuns. But after that, more and more rules came up. So those that are different are basically only for the nuns, not for the monks.
Dear Four Venerables, what do you enjoy the most out of being a nun? Meaning, what is the thing that keeps or sustains you with motivation in your practice year after year or for life? Thank you, with metta. For me, what sustains me, just because I can't think of a better thing to be doing with my time. I think, you know, if I'm going to spend my time doing something and putting my energy and my life into it, I want it to bear fruit. And being a lawyer, which is what I'd be if I wasn't here, very little, you know, to hang on to in that. Just, yeah, I'd make money, I'd support myself, but even if I had a career as a lawyer in a human rights area, which is what I was aiming for, very hard field to get into, it still wouldn't have been that rewarding, whereas this is very rewarding.
Dear Venerable Gotami, you are a mother, grandma, auntie, Do you still have attachment to your children and grandkids when they don't visit you? Do you question them? Well, I have got, I have, besides my four sons, I have three daughters-in-law and two grandchildren. When I first came into the monastery, well, I still have a lot of attachment. Sometimes I walk through the forest to my kuti, and I hear my son calling me. I turn around. I don't see anybody. So I know it's just my imagination. And whenever they ask me to go to their homes, I'm so delighted. Can't wait to go. And very happy to talk to them on the phone. Sometimes talk too long. But as time goes on, the attachment got less because I'm always in the monastery. So even the children also, they call me home quite often when I first joined as a nun. But nowadays also, I guess they don't miss me so much, and I also don't miss them so much. So if they don't call me back, it's also good. I have more time to meditate. Otherwise, I go back talking. When I come back, I can't settle my mind very easily. So it's quite good to stay quiet in the monastery, and you just get used to it, and also you get used to being separated from your family. So you it's okay. They come, it's fine. They don't come, it's fine. Okay.
This just says, dear Venerables, in New South Wales at Santi, are bhikkhunis being supported by monks from other temples in teaching or material needs on your path? Is that being supported by monks from other temples in teaching or material needs on your path? Could you perhaps tell us your experience of high and low being a bhikkhuni? Well, I'm not a bhikkhuni yet, yes, Santi is very well supported, actually. There's a lot of many Sri Lankan communities who come and support Santi. Whether we're being supported by other monks from other temples, it's not that we're not supported, but certainly Ajahn Brahm is our spiritual director at Santi, and Ajahn Sujato, when he's in Australia, he's very supportive. We have monks coming and staying if they want to come for a short period of time. We've had different monks stay, so certainly those monks who are supportive of bhikkhunis are very happy to support us in any way. But it's ticking over quite well with the fairly local support there, so all's good on that. I spoke a little bit about the difficulties and the challenges of being a nun, so I won't go there.
Dear Venerables, do nuns and monks celebrate birthdays? What do they do on that day? Actually, in Dhammasrara Monastery, many of the nuns, they take a lot of interest in each one's birthday. Very good of them, very kind of them. And they make beautiful cards for whoever's birthday it is. Really very nice. Sometimes they draw the cat or whatever. But it's really very nice. And also whoever works in the kitchen, when they know that it's somebody's birthday, They take the trouble to make cake or cook something special. So that is how we celebrate the birthday. Yeah, very kind of them. I've been not quite interested in my birthday since quite a long time because I was more interested in spiritual practice. So I don't put very much interest in birthdays. But in the monastery now, the nuns really take a lot of care in preparing birthday cards, and those in the kitchen also work very hard to celebrate your birthday for you. So it's very nice.
I was just going to read the questions that I've pulled out of the box that we probably won't answer because we already have. The first one is, dear nuns, can we start by introducing yourselves? I think we know each other now. The next one is, dear venerables, why is it there are more rules for nuns than monks? Is it to protect you or to supervise? Can you give some examples? I think Venerable Gotami covered that. It's not to supervise. You can ask Ajahn Brahm about the Garu Dhammas another time because that's a very long conversation. Another question is specifically to says, dear Ajahn, it was a wonderful way to start the day with a little bit of your brilliant guided meditation. It made my day. Thanks, Ajahn. So I'll put that back in the basket so he can read that. And then the last one is for me, Venerable Sarata. I know who this is from, I think. Please give your journey to Dhamma schooling. I've kind of done that already. And the next part is, how is it living uphill with metta? I've moved into Ajahn Vayama's old caravan, and it's wonderful. It's a whole new postcode, just about. Bit of a trek up the hill behind the stupa. But it's very, very quiet. I love it. And that is the end of the questions.